Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the privilege, from time to time, to pick the brains of a man of uncommon intelligence, and it is informed by a lot of experience on the ground, as well as through his service as the publisher of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is, of course, Russ Dallin, a principal in Caracas Capital and a regular feature of this program for his expertise about Latin America. Russ Dallin, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to catch up with you briefly.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Listen, I wanted to get your thoughts on this Summit of the Americas that is taking place in Lima, Peru, in the days to come. The President of the United States will not be there. A point is being made that this is the first time since these summits began that that has happened. He will be represented, of course, by Vice President Pence, and the reason given is that he's staying here to monitor and make decisions about Syria. But I did want to get your sense of this summit, its importance, and whether it makes a difference that it's the Vice President rather than the President who's there. Does this say something, as some are imputing to it, that Latin America just isn't all that important to the Trump administration? What are your thoughts?
Well, you're right. I mean, at face glance, it does make it look not as important that Mr. Trump would pull out this week, just a few days before it. Vice President Pence, though, for the issues that have to be done, has been on the vanguard of the defense of Venezuela. And indeed, Venezuela is the probably the main topic and the main thing that's going to come out of the summit. It's a shame that it will lack the flair and panache that the President Trump can bring to it. But Vice President Pence will be ably assisted by Senator Marco Rubio, who not only is an expert on the region and has been driving Venezuela and Cuba policy in the region, but also speaks the language of the region. So he's kind of an ace that the administration has in the hole.
So we talk with you most of the time, at least in part, about Venezuela. It's on the agenda for sure. Russ Dallin, first of all, I guess, give us an update on how things are going there at the moment, both internally, the economic situation, the political situation, as well as the impact on its neighbors of the mass migration out of Venezuela in light of the difficult circumstances there?
Frank, it's bad and continues to get worse. And you hit the nail on the head. There's massive migration because people have been working all their lives for a company, and Venezuela has enjoyed a very high standard of living. It was a founding member of OPEC. It has the world's largest oil reserves, more than Saudi Arabia. But the basic problem is that with corruption and Chavista corruption, a kind of Khmer Rouge light kind of purging and persecution of the intelligentsia, and just the ridiculous economic policies that communism brings, has brought this nation to its knees. And people that have been working in the oil company all their life for great salaries suddenly are not able to buy food for a day's worth, much less for 30 days on their monthly salary. So they're fleeing the country. It's as if a war had happened, yet no war has happened.
Well, and in a fashion, a war, I guess, the people of Venezuela and certainly its economy has been happening. But, of course, it's of the non-kinetic kind mostly. Give us a sense, Russ Dallin, and I know you cover these issues very closely at the Latin American Herald Tribune, but how massive is the migration, and how much of a problem has it begun to constitute for neighboring nations?
It's terrible because these people that are fleeing the country, they were making in Venezuela what was once a good salary is now worth about $4 a month. They're trying to live on $4 a month. So they're fleeing the country. They have nothing because they've been undergoing this for a while because there has been no war. It's just every month you hear, oh, well, it's going to get better. And that goes on for years and years and years till you're down to making $4 a month. And finally, you have no choice because you can't feed your family. You can't buy shoes. You have to leave the country. So the poor are streaming across the borders into Brazil, malnourished with all kinds of diseases because there's a breakdown in the medical system. There's no medicines. There's not even alcohol. There's not even Clorox to clean things. And the underlying fundamentals are going to make it worse because OPEC just reported yesterday that Venezuela's production fell below 1.5 million barrels a day for the first time, basically, since this is 1949. Venezuela hasn't produced this low amount of oil since 1949.
And this is basically, as I understand it, because the government of Venezuela and the state-owned petrol company have run their ability to extract oil into the ground. So this gives rise to a desperate situation, clearly, Rust Allen. What is likely to come of discussions of all of this at the Summit of the Americas, as you see it?
They're going to try and drive back Venezuela back onto the path of democracy. And the way they're going to do that is sanctions. Unfortunately, sanctions on Cuba never drove that country back to a democratic transition. And what we're seeing in Venezuela is the same thing. While the sanctions are having effect, they are targeting the government officials. Even the EU has named officials, and even Panama now has sanctioned individuals and prevented them from having bank accounts in the country to seize them because of the high levels of corruption in the government. But the bottom line is that these people have nowhere to go. But diplomacy has to be tried, and that's we're seeing the last gasp of whether diplomacy can actually, everyone in the region can push this country back on the path it should have been on as one of the richest countries in the region.
Yeah. Democracy, of course, is still practiced in a pro forma sense. The problem is, of course, the opposition is unable to really compete and the votes are rigged and all the rest of it. So it does seem as though more is going to be needed, especially if this problem is to be prevented from destabilizing or at the very least creating profound economic problems for other nations that may not be able to deal with it either. Do you see any prospect, especially with nations that are tied to the Venezuelan regime of Nicolas Maduro, like Nicaragua and Bolivia and most especially Cuba, that anything can come out of these conversations other than, you know, fulminating about how serious a problem it is? Will there be any decision taken to intensify sanctions to the point of really being a problem for the regime, let alone bringing to bear force from outside to bring it down?
I think we're in the last gasp of the diplomatic efforts. If these diplomatic efforts are unsuccessful, I'm afraid that we're going to have to end up continuing diplomacy by other means.
Indeed. Diplomacy by other means is a very interesting turn of phrase. Rust Allen, we expect nothing less of you, an accomplished practitioner of the business of reporting on these things at the Latin American Herald Tribune. Thank you for the work you do there. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State, about, well, narco trafficking as well, another affliction of the region, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to have joining us, I believe for the first time, long overdue, Robert Charles. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State responsible for international narcotics and law enforcement affairs during the Bush administration. He is a naval intelligence officer as well as a trained litigator who has served, in addition, in the White Houses of George H.W. Bush and prior to that, my old boss, Ronald Reagan. He is the founder president and managing member of the Charles Group, LLC. He is, well, a utility infielder, and we're delighted to welcome him. Robert Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Let me talk to you first about something that was in your former portfolio at the State Department, narco-trafficking. We were just discussing with Russ Dallin the unbelievable freefall of the nation of Venezuela, now clearly no longer a democracy. In fact, a narco-trafficking thugocracy, I think, is probably more accurate to say. A subject for the upcoming Summit of the Americas. Another problem that is looming that I'd love to get your thoughts on, knowing you to be a serious student of these matters as well as a practitioner, is the prospect that a similar fate may be in the offing for our neighbor to the south, Mexico, especially if the prospective frontrunner in a presidential election there, a gentleman by the name of López Obrador, were to come to power. Robert Charles, what are your thoughts on all of that?
I think, Frank, you are prescient to have turned the great circling searchlight onto this hemisphere. It has been away for a while. And I think you're prescient for several reasons. First, you're right about Venezuela. Venezuela is in free fall. It is a socialist country that has migrated rapidly toward the dictatorship communist end of the spectrum. Its people are starving. Its energy sector is collapsed. And the result of that, I think we can fairly predict, is going to be a spike not only in domestic crime, but refugee cross-border flows, elevated involvement in drug trafficking, which they are already involved in, and really a crisis in our own midst that we all have to be at least thoughtful about, because trying in some way to preempt that is probably important for all the allies, all of us in this hemisphere. The second thing that you point to is Mexico, and you're right, there's an election this summer which will be pivotal, as there is in Colombia, by the way. And both of those countries are really source countries for a large amount of the drugs that come into this country. Mexico is a source of black tar heroin and marijuana, large quantities. Colombia, of course, is a huge source of both cocaine and heroin. And one of the things to note about the white heroin coming out of Colombia, and in particular the coca crop, is that we've seen 3 years now, because we walked away from support for the counter-narcotics efforts in that country, we've seen 3 years of double-digit increases in coca production, which, if you just do the math and look carefully at a map and go back to the 90s, you can see what that's going to mean. We're currently in the midst of an opioid and heroin crisis in the United States, as well as synthetics and drugs like fentanyl that come from China. But we're also about to see a wave of cocaine, unfortunately, ramping up. And I spend time with agency heads around the government, and I will tell you they're very concerned about it. So if you put those three countries together, and the sources of instability within them, I think we have what amounts to a crescent of real concern in this hemisphere. I would hate to see Colombia return to the bad old days. The United States worked collectively with them, methodically with them, over the last 15, 20 years to put them on a track where they're now a tourist destination and things are good there. Mexico is in turmoil. I mean, frankly, it was only 20 years ago or so that people in Mexico City left their doors unlocked. Today, it is unfortunately a place swept by both crime, drug-related crime, and unfortunately, in some ways, a potential sort of a view of what could happen in not just the southwestern United States, but across the United States, if we don't both work together with them to battle the narcotics issue and understand that a degree of fair play is obviously needed in the trade environment.
Chilling prognosis, to say the least, Robert Charles. Let me switch to the United States, though, for a moment with you, Robert. You have legal training and have been writing at FoxNews.com about some of the latest developments in this bizarre saga of the pursuit of the president by the special prosecutor and, it seems, elements of his own Justice Department. One that caught my eye was an analysis of what these FBI raids on some of the work and residential properties of the president's personal lawyer, Cohen, has given rise to in terms of a threat to all of us. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, you know, Frank, you're absolutely right. And
as you know, better than almost anybody, I think, in the media industry and from your life experience, freedom is both gained and often lost by inches. And we don't see the migration of the tide away from the freedom we had until it's gone, until pieces of it that we always counted on are gone. And what you just experienced, what all Americans, if they sit up straight and look carefully at what has happened, what we've just experienced is a real trouncing of the Fourth Amendment.
That's the unreasonable search and seizure provision, as I recall. Is that right?
Exactly right. The Fourth Amendment is that assurance that the founders thought was so important that we would be safe in our homes and our personal effects, that they put it into the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. And I think that what we misunderstand, or what we were at risk of losing, is a full understanding of what that recent raid means. In some other country, in the old Soviet-dominated Poland or Czechoslovakia or East Germany or Soviet Union, all of which I spent time in, it was not uncommon to sit in a home of someone who had that home invaded on the pretense of some lawful invasion, but it was really a political act. It was going after the dissidents. That's why I was sitting with them. And it was always chilling to me because I thought, my God, what is sacred if a person's home is not sacred? And if they can't, you know, all their effects were rummaged through very often. They were taken, the effects were taken, and sometimes the people were taken. And it was a truly chilling thing. So to read how this went forward, and the reason this is so unusual, get away for a moment from the salacious facts that the media loves to report. The reason this is so unusual is that you have an attorney-client privilege, and in this case, the only reason that can be penetrated is if the attorney is uncooperative and involved in some crime of his own. Well, in this particular case, and it has to be pretty egregious to go into a home, go into an office. In this case, they went into three separate locations of his and took everything, because you're violating the attorney-client privilege of not only one client, but all the clients. And you're going in after his personal effects. So in this case, this attorney, by the record, was very cooperative. He was responding. He had given thousands of documents to the special counsel. He had done two depositions with the special counsel. And while it's true that there is a fraud exception, it's extremely narrow. We can't have the norm be around the United States that if you are politically affiliated with one party, and you have some shadow of involvement in anything, we're going to come into your home, rip it up, and take everything we want. That cannot be the norm. And so, interestingly, even case law says that this should be the last act. There's an exhaustion of remedies requirement. And I find it really chilling to me personally to hear that someone associated with the president, in a sense, because he is associated with the president, and nevertheless being cooperative in his production of information in the discovery process, nevertheless, without any particular reason to believe that that there are exigent circumstances, he's not trying to destroy this material. There's no indication of that. They get a judge, which is not hard, to sign off on a list of reasons that amount to, according to the prosecutor, probable cause to go in and take everything. That, to me, is a very chilling moment in American history. And while we don't, you know, we don't look at it right now as an inflection point, I think in a year or two we may.
Yeah. Let me turn to one other issue. You have apparently had an opportunity to take a look at least some of the excerpts that are available at the moment of former FBI Director Jim Comey's new book, being promoted breathlessly by the media at the moment. Tell us what you have found and some of the concerns you've expressed in your most recent Fox News column about this, Robert Charles.
Well, I think that the biggest issue that we see in this Comey book is that there's not much there. So what that says to me is that a different norm of what I'll call civil society at the political level has really been, again, abrogated. And that norm was that a president depends upon the inner circle. It doesn't matter whether it's President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, President Reagan, President Trump. He depends upon an inner circle of senior, extremely well-informed experts, and they range broadly from his secretaries of defense and homeland security and his chief of staff to the head of the FBI. And what just happened here is that a head of the FBI, who I used to sit with, incidentally, when he was the deputy attorney general, when we were in the National Security Council and I was serving with Colin Powell and under George W. Bush, I always remember this fellow as being very even-tempered and quiet. And I think there came a moment where he started to speak out and got a lot of applause from the Democrat community, in particular for, you know, opposing surveillance of terrorists, and in particular for his words on framing things as torture as when we were trying to protect the country. All of a sudden, he was getting lots of applause. And the man that I knew as sort of quiet and more thoughtful, lifetime law enforcement officer, really evolved into a political figure. And what you just see in this book is the sad sort of terminus of that frame of reference. What he's done, Frank, is that he's gone from being a trusted public servant. He was fired really for bad judgment. And I mean, let's be honest. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Look back at what he's done in the last 2 years. Bad judgment is probably the easiest, best, and most accurate way to describe it. So, you know, he was fired for bad judgment.
Well, we'll take very much to heart the point you've made. You're an exemplary public servant in your own right, Robert Charles, and I think your criticism of him on that score is very well taken. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you'll come back often. It's great to talk with you, and we appreciate so much your past service, as well as that you're rendering these days, among other places, at Fox News, and of course, as a member of the Charles Group, LLC. Next up, we'll speak with Avi Jorish. We'll talk about innovation in Israel and terror financing around the world, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is great to have with us a man we have not spoken to in a frightfully long time, I'm sorry to say, and I think that's partly due to the fact that he's been off writing a very important new book. It is entitled Thou Shalt Innovate, a fascinating look at what Israel is doing in the way of innovation and what it means for all the rest of us. And this is one of, I think, five of his very highly regarded books. Avi is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council and an active contributor to the public policy debate in the private sector these days, as he used to be a very accomplished policy practitioner in the departments of the Treasury and the Defense Department in the public sector in the past. It's great to have him back, among other things. Avi, congratulations on Thou Shalt Innovate.
Thank you, Frank. It's always wonderful to be back on your show. I'm so pleased to have some time with you today. Thanks.
Good. The pleasure's mine. Listen, tell us a little bit about the thesis of the book, and in particular, the relevance of what Israel has been doing in the innovation domain for, well, our country, among others.
Sure. So Thou Shalt Innovate is a book that features innovations that have come from Israel that have had a global impact and have improved the lives of billions of people collectively. If you look at the innovations coming from Israel today, they're improving the lives of billions of people when it comes to water, medicine, science, agriculture, food. We're seeing an unbelievable amount of innovation coming out of the country, making a real impact on how people live their lives and what they're doing. And I attribute that to a number of different factors. The innovative part of the country comes as a result of, I believe, great universities, smart government programs, resource awareness when it comes to water, a very rich, diverse culture, the idea of grit and resilience and determination. And underlying all that is a highly innovative military. And when you couple that with the prophetic tradition that has been around for 3,000 years and encouraging people to improve the world, you have not only a highly innovative society, but a society that is reaching out to the rest of humanity and making it better. And so not only improving the lives of their own citizens, but improving the lives of citizens around the world.
Yeah. Let me just ask you to drill down on one example of this. You mentioned water. As you know, Avi, water is becoming a precious resource in lots of places, including Israel's neighbor, Egypt. What has Israel been able to do to try to help address the acute need of Egyptians for water, and thereby making that important strategic partner for Egypt hopefully more secure for the future?
I'm so pleased that you asked. So Israel is first, we start by saying Israel is the only country in the world to have declared water independence. And when I say water independence, it is not dependent on the weather or its neighbors for its own water needs.
And that is a country in a desert, it should be remembered. So that's saying something, isn't it?
Israel is 60% desert and the only country in the world to have achieved this. And so Israel has done this using a number of different innovations. One, desalination. Okay, the country has 5 desalination plants, and as a result has a surplus of water. I should point out this was not innovated in Israel. Desalination was innovated in the United States by gentlemen who actually made Aliyah to Israel and perfected that technology in Israel. Secondly, the country innovated something called drip irrigation, and you can find this in most gardens in the United States and around the world today. It's essentially plastic tubes that emit water drop by drop very slowly, which is used by over 1 billion people around the world today, and it uses 1/3 of the water and doubles the yield of any crop. Third, Israel is a leader in the world when it comes to recycling. So when we go to the bathroom and we flush the toilet, Israel takes out, removes the waste, cleans the water 5 times, and recycles 90% of its water for agriculture. It is the world's leader. And just to understand where it stands in the hierarchy, Israel is 90%. The second country down is Singapore at 20%. And here in the United States, we're at 8%. And when you couple that with dual flush toilets and early detection systems that alert city authorities to when there are leaks, Israel has been able to accomplish a great feat. Now, Israel has been taking this, the sum of the whole is greater than its parts approach, and started teaching its neighbors and countries around the world how to build a water surplus. Now, bringing it to Egypt. Egypt in 7 years is facing a water problem of biblical proportions. It is going to run out of water. And when you think about where they're going to turn, it only makes sense that Egypt is going to turn to its neighbor, Israel, the startup nation, the only country in the world to have declared water independence. And as I look to the future, this is one of the things I am most hopeful about. When you look at Israel's relationship with its neighbors, near and far, you can see that Israel is a country that is solving global problems. In California, Israel has built the largest desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere. In places like India and China, Israel has built the largest desalination plants. And Israel has this formula for water independence. It will continue to promote that model for the benefit of humanity.
This is fantastic, Avi, and I'm so grateful that you've pulled this information together. It is inspiring, as well as I suspect the kind of thing that will translate into further benefits as more people learn about these innovations in your book, Thou Shalt Innovate. Hey, speaking of your books, let me ask you about one that you've written about in Beacon of Hatred, which is a book about Hezbollah's Al-Manar television network. I'm interested not so much in the network as in what Hezbollah is up to, Avi, and in particular, what it's done to, talk about innovation, to amass this immense arsenal of missiles and rockets capable of reaching, as I understand it, all of Israel. Some 150,000 of them by some counts. As well as what it's doing now with Iranian and Russian and Syrian help in Syria, that's greatly intensifying the threat to Israel from the north.
So obviously Hezbollah is a radical Islamic organization with an ideology of death and destruction. They're very proud of the fact that what motivates them is death and killing versus the value of life. And allow me to just tie it back to innovation for just a moment in regards to these rockets. Israel is essentially, I don't want to say solved that problem, but in 2012, Israel was the first country in the world to innovate a missile defense system that is able to shoot projectiles out of the sky. And that system is called the Iron Dome. It has a 90% success rate. I should also point out that it's the only rocket system in the entire world to have parts from Toys R Us in the system itself. It's highly innovative. It's relatively inexpensive. And it is able to shoot out these projectiles with 90% success rate. And so Israelis, when they go to bed at night, they know that they can find comfort under the system called the Iron Dome, whether it comes from radical Islamic threats emanating from Lebanon, from Gaza, or other parts of the Arab world. Hezbollah has been very robust in places like Syria, spreading its ideology of hate and destruction, working very closely alongside their colleagues and friends in Iran. Iran, interestingly, is also facing its own water crisis. If you look a decade or two into the future, among other things, 50% of its population are going to become water refugees. Who do you think they're going to turn to when they run out of water? I tend to think that it's going to be the state of Israel. And so as your listeners look to the next few years, the Middle East is about to change radically as a result of innovation. How are organizations like Hezbollah and Iran going to deal with this?
I fear that there's a certain, as you know, 12-er mentality operating, at least at the senior-most ranks of the Iranian regime, Avi Jorsh, that holds that, the end is of times is at hand, and they're just going to count on the Mahdi to sort all this out in some sort of horrific, apocalyptic thrash. But I did want to just emphasize the point you've just made, that the Iron Dome, I had a hand in the Memorandum of Understanding back in the Reagan administration with Israel that gave rise to collaboration between our two countries on missile defense, and so feel a certain satisfaction that the progress the Israelis have made. It's one thing to be dealing with the numbers of these projectiles that they, as you say, the Sharia supremacists in Gaza and perhaps even Sinai or Lebanon might throw at them. But if that arsenal is unleashed, it's going to be a very tough deal, even for a defense like the Iron Dome. So it makes all the more important preventing that kind of conflict from happening. And this this brings me to the larger question. I have the feeling that as you've done due diligence on the banking system of Iran, among other features of its nefarious operations, there are real vulnerabilities there to be exploited, whether it's water in the future or whether it's the collapsing currency at the moment or the demographic change that's taking place with large numbers of young people who have no use for this regime. If you were advising President Trump at the moment, Avi Jorsh, what would you be counseling he do about Iran to intensify those problems, I guess, in the short term for the purpose of alleviating the danger that this regime represents to all of us?
So in part, I would focus on innovation. One, I would encourage us to offer visas to a lot of their greatest scientists. Iran is a highly innovative society, and we could and should consider causing a massive brain drain to take place from Iran to the United States. Secondly, when it comes to banking sanctions, there's no reason why we should open the banking system to Iran. They have proved time and time again that their banking system has been used to proliferate weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. The sanctions regime against that country should be increased. And the thin edge of the wedge is the banking sector. We should be identifying banks that are playing a hand in proliferating weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I'm for that, needless to say. And Avi Jorsh, your expertise in these matters is greatly appreciated, as is your time at this Defense Department and the Treasury Department working in that kind of battle space. Come back to us again very soon. Meantime, have a good weekend. It's great to talk with you, and we'll look forward to doing more of it. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll be talking with him about Chinese communists on campus and what they're up to and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Bill Gertz, one of the great investigative reporters of our time. His beat is national security. His column at the Washington Times, for which he has been properly recognized with awards, is Inside the Ring. He is also the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon and the author of seven, count 'em, seven best-selling books, including most recently, IWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you as always. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
So, a lot of things I want to cover with you, Bill. One that caught my eye was your report at the Free Beacon about Chinese communist espionage on college campuses, the extent to which this is really symptomatic, it seems to me, of a larger and yawning, seriously inadequate counterintelligence problem on our side. Talk to me a little bit about how that is manifesting itself in America's academic institutions and the import of it.
Yeah, this is based on a story that I did for the Free Beacon this week, and it was the result of a House congressional hearing. The House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology had a bunch of experts come in and talk about what was basically described as a massive theft of American technology and research from college campuses through espionage. And to compound the problem, one of the experts who testified, Michelle Van Cleve, former National Counterintelligence Executive, revealed that the Obama administration had weakened U.S. counterintelligence capabilities. That is, the ability of a national level strategic counterintelligence program to attack that problem. So it's kind of a twofold problem. But in terms of what the Chinese are going after on campuses, it's no surprise that they have a targeted program that's done at the highest levels of the Chinese government, and it's directed through their intelligence services to get our cutting-edge technologies, whether it's robotics, especially robotics and artificial intelligence. So those are the two areas where, of course, that have tremendous military potential.
Hugely important problem. And I guess this is not so much a function of the large numbers of Chinese nationals that are on our campuses, but the deep efforts of the Chinese to simply get into and exploit our campuses as places where some of this technology that they want is being innovated, Bill?
Yes. It's a combination of professional intelligence agency collectors, whether it's the MSS or the 2PLA, which is their military arm, or the use of Chinese students, of which there are some 350,000. So that makes a base for exploiting their work, along with Chinese researchers that are going into these high-tech fields. For example, one of the people who testified was Michael Wessel, who's the head of the U.S.-China Commission, the Congressional U.S.-China Commission. And he said that a large percentage of the people working at Berkeley's artificial intelligence laboratory are PRC nationals, which, of course, makes a great risk that they're going to steal the technology from that.
Indeed. And this comes, of course, as well. You've been reporting on the Confucius Institute's contribution to some of these counterintelligence problems, Bill Gertz. And it's the kind of thing that I've long believed is in need of urgent attention. And more generally, as is the shortfall of our counterintelligence capabilities. Speaking of capabilities, the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, was up testifying this week on Capitol Hill about efforts he's making to try to increase the lethality of our military forces. Bill, what light can you shed on what's afoot there?
Yeah, the Defense Secretary Jim Mattis testified at the House Armed Services Committee yesterday. And again, the key word in his testimony was increasing the lethality of American forces. And for the first time, in his prepared testimony, he outlined what those areas where he's investing in key technologies, and they include cyber warfare, advanced computing, big data analytics, artificial intelligence, autonomy, robotics, miniaturization, and directed energy and hypersonics. So he said these are the technologies that we need to fight and win the wars of the future. So it's good that they're on his radar screen now. Let's hope that with the really broken procurement system, that too can be fixed. It's also another of his high priorities is to fix the ability to build weapons in time before they become obsolete.
Yeah. In part, I assume this list is a function of what he's watching other nations, not just the Chinese, but the Russians especially, engaging in the hopes of having, you know, the ability to dominate the battle space in the future. We've got to be able to deny them that opportunity, it seems to me. Speaking of which, Bill, one of the other things that you reported on this week that caught my eye was the evidence that the United States military is preparing to do unto others what we've reason to believe they have in mind doing to us, namely to get inside through cyber techniques their critical infrastructure and disrupt, if not destroy it. Talk a little bit about what we've learned in this regard.
Yeah, this was based on the testimony of Lieutenant General Paul Nakasone, who's the nominee to be the next Cyber Command commander, as well as the National Security Agency director. And he revealed in written answers to questions to the Senate Intelligence Committee that the U.S. is ready to do counterattacks on foreign infrastructure, specifically those of China and Russia. And this is based on the fact that both of those nations have conducted extensive penetration, reconnaissance, and mapping of our critical infrastructures. This was put within the context of U.S. deterrence strategy. They're trying to develop a strategy that could deter adversaries in cyberspace by having the ability to strike back and bring down their networks, should they even consider trying to strike ours.
Yeah, it's certainly needed. I think there's no question, as you've documented in your writings, Bill Gertz, that there are hostile powers who have been getting inside our wire, as they say, literally, or wireless, as the case may be, to threaten, if not actually begin disrupting our critical infrastructure, particularly the grid, made all the more outrageous because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has recently, as you probably know, sort of agreed that cyber threats are not a problem for our grid. It's just insanity. I'm hoping that John Bolton will make a priority of trying to remedy this vulnerability of our infrastructure, as well as ensure that our ability to deal with great effect with others is made as robust as we can. Speaking of threats, Bill Gertz, lastly, would you just tell us a little bit about this Russian anti-satellite missile that you've reported has now been tested some six times, and its implications for our use of and reliance upon space?
Yeah, this was based on my Washington Times Inside the Ring column, which revealed that Russia recently conducted a test of what they call the New Dawl, direct ascent anti-satellite missile. It's one of the sixth tests in at least 3 or 4 years, and it shows that this is a high priority program. And once again, that the Russians, just like the Chinese, are preparing for space warfare, something which the U.S. is very vulnerable and is in urgent need of fixing that problem, either by countering those weapons or by developing a hardened and more secure satellites.
All of these are topics on which we're very grateful you're focusing attention, because it means that we get to focus ours as well. Bill Gertz, thank you so much for what you do at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. Again, I commend all of you his newest book, iWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks. We'll talk to you again next week. We'll talk to the rest of you, I hope, again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.